and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, June 27th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Hollywood set designer helps elevate popular Halloween attraction in Clear Lake. When Bob Sherman decided to upgrade his haunted attraction in Clear Lake, he knew just the person to call. 5 weeks ago, he called Bob Hummel, a longtime friend and veteran production designer with more than 300 film and TV credits, including Jeepers Creepers 3. "I was just looking for a quality-looking set that can up the look of the whole hike," Sherman said. The men's friendship dates back to 1995 at Iverson Movie Ranch in Chatsworth, California, which was the backdrop for thousands of film and TV productions like The Lone Ranger and The Roy Rogers Show between 1912 and 1997. Sherman bought the ranch from his uncle, Joe Iverson, in 1980, and he sold it in 1997. Sherman and Hummel have worked on a lot of movies together in various capacities, they said, including a remake of the 1965 crime thriller Psycho a Go-Go that they were supposed to begin filming in April. However, production of the thriller and many other films has been halted due to the coronavirus pandemic. "We have no idea what's going to happen," Hummel said. Because of that, Sherman, who now resides in Clear Lake, turned his attention to the Nightmare Haunted Hike, formerly known as D&D Ranch Haunted Hike. The hike is located at 2532 South Shore Drive, and it has drawn hundreds of people of all ages for some spooky fun for more than a decade. Sherman operates the hike with his ex-wife, Debbie Anderson, and several friends and volunteers. "We make a big effort to change a lot of it every year," he said, noting changes to sets, lighting, and sound effects. 2 years ago, a 1,500-square-foot indoor area featuring six horror sets designed after popular movies like Carrie, Krampus, and Silent Hill, as well as the Black Rose Boutique, replaced five small 1800s buildings that were falling apart. This year, Sherman wanted to upgrade the hike's graveyard. Hummel, who drew the conceptual designs weeks before arriving in Clear Lake, said the project has mushroomed into something big. Within the past 2.5 weeks, Hummel and Sherman have worked 14-hour days to turn a blank space on the acreage into a gated graveyard complete with headstones and Dracula's tomb. "We have accomplished more than I anticipated," Hummel said. Hummel, who prides himself on being able to take a low budget and turn it into a high budget looking product, said the tomb, which can be seen from South Shore Drive, will likely provide a wow factor halfway through the hike. In addition to the headstones dotting the yard in front of the tomb, Sherman said there would be a large cemetery located behind it that people will wander through before entering the cornfield maze. "This is Bob's trade," Sherman said. "I have an imagination, but this is his second nature." Hummel returned to California Thursday before the project was completed, but he hopes to visit in October to experience the finished product. "It will be fun when it's done," he said. Currently, the hike takes about 25 minutes, but with the changes, it'll likely be longer. Historically, the hike, including its zombie apocalypse paintball bus, has been open on the weekends in October. But Sherman said he'd like to expand its season as a tourist attraction beyond Halloween into the summer and fall in Clear Lake. While the haunted hike won't be ready to open before the fall this year, he said zombie paintball would be available in July. "Clear Lake is a tourist town, but really there's not a whole lot of tourist activities," Sherman said. "This will just offer an option." Paintball will be included in the hike's ticket price this year instead of separate as in years past. Sherman has other upgrades to the haunted hike, as well as film projects in Clear Lake planned for the future involving Hummel. The men would love to bring the film industry to Iowa, especially North Iowa, to give Hollywood a fresh look, they said. "I'm looking to bring the movie business here," Hummel said. "I gave him five scripts that we could shoot right here. It'd help the economy and put Iowa on the map." For more information about the Nightmare Haunted Hike, call 641-357-1695 or visit its Facebook page. Cannonball Day in Mason City canceled. There will be no Cannonball Day this year. After being pushed back from June 27th to August 29th to account for the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, organizer Dennis Wilson announced that the yearly event would need to be nixed due to the uncertainty of the next couple of months and the unavailability of some vendors. The canceled event joins the likes of the North Iowa Fair, North Iowa Band Festival, and Clear Lake's 2020 4th of July celebration as happenings that won't happen because of the pandemic. The annual Cannonball Day event, started by Friends of the 457 more than a decade ago, highlights the Minneapolis and St. Louis steam locomotive in Mason City's East Park. The Friends of the 457 started Cannonball Day to fund the restoration and preservation of the M and St. L 457, a 1912 steam engine better known as the Rotary Cannonball. The Friends' mission for Cannonball Day is to provide a day promoting healthy living and lifestyles for kids. According to Wilson, the River City Kiwanis and Evening Lions are still working on details of offering the Cannonball Famous Chicken Barbecue on August 29th as a drive-up feature only. The Rotary Cannonball engine will open up for walking tours around the engine Saturday, July 4th, and weekends through October if conditions permit. For more information about Cannonball Day and the Friends of the 457, visit friendsofthe457.org. Still a mystery 25 years later, looking back at Jody Huizentrup case. This week marks the 25th anniversary of the disappearance of well-known KIMT TV morning anchor Jody Huizentrup. The 27-year-old went missing from her apartment complex in the early morning hours of June 27, 1995. Exhaustive searches led by law enforcement, family, and concerned community members saw no results, and Huizentrup was declared legally dead in May 2001 by her family. The case remains open. If you have any information regarding Jody's disappearance, call the Mason City Police Department at 641-421-3636. Mexican Eatery keeps it local. North End Restaurant prioritizes traditional homestyle cuisine. Maria Villegas wants her restaurant in Mason City's North End neighborhood to feel like a community. She lives in the area, works in the area, and tries to buy ingredients in the area as much as she can. I believe that the small local businesses need a chance, especially when people started telling me that the North End has a bad rep, Villegas said. As steadfastly local as Villegas' business approach is, the menu for La Fiesta Tienda Mexicana is anything but. Instead of offering Tex-Mex cuisine options, which is more commonplace at Mexican restaurants the farther they are from the border, the menu at La Fiesta prioritizes more traditional cuisine and homestyle options. So something like mojarra frita, a whole tilapia fried and served with beans and rice, isn't out of the question. Nor are tacos de lengua, slow-braised beef tongue, or tripa. When they see it on the menu, they kind of freak out, but they try it and maybe they'll like it, Vieja says. According to her, when the restaurant first opened back in November, it was a bit of a learning curve for some customers coming in who only knew Tex-Mex style. But Villegas helped do some educating, and business steadily picked up right through when the pandemic hit Iowa in mid-March, and her business, like so many others, had to make major changes. Villegas said La Fiesta was shut down for the rest of March, as well as all of April and most of May. When La Fiesta reopened, Villegas said that a slow but steady stream of patrons started to come back in. Since it has reopened, a big to-do for La Fiesta has been its gorditas, which come in two varieties, one deep-fried and one cooked on a griddle. Both of them are handmade and filled with cheese. Neither have anything to do with what Taco Bell offers, which is basically a pita by another name. I love Taco Bell gorditas, but it is totally different from the homemade gorditas we make, Villegas said. In fact, the gordita de queso owes more to the Salvadorian pupusa griddle cake than a typical Mexican gordita. Instead of just regular cheese, though, it blends cheese with red sauce and gives the finished product an orange color. Of any item on the menu, Villegas said that she most enjoys the enchilada options. Our enchiladas, we actually fry the handmade tortilla within the sauce, then roll it up with cheese or chicken, whatever they would like, Villegas said. For toppings, there could be sautéed potatoes, carrots, onions, lettuce, and sour cream. According to Villegas, the recipes are a mix of those given by family members, her mother-in-law and grandmother, and what she can whip up based on the supplies that are available. Those that come from family members straddle two neighboring states in Mexico, Guanajuato and Jalisco. Two different states, two different foods, Villegas says. For other items on the still-expanding menu, necessity has been the mother of invention, like the queso fresco, which is a crucial ingredient for a number of Mexican dishes. Villegas said she looked local first for a good source of the crumbly cheese and didn't have any luck at all. That continued as she expanded her search. We tried moving up to the bigger cities, couldn't find anything. We ended up looking in Des Moines and nada, Villegas said. The best source she could find for now is in Chicago. That's a problem she thinks is worth rectifying. We have many towns and cities with Hispanics and nothing, she said. So in the next few months, Villegas is planning on opening a grocery store across from Northside Liquor. The store won't just be limited to Mexico-specific food items, however. Villegas said she also intends to stock items from Guatemala, El Salvador, and other Latin American countries. Like the restaurant itself, Villegas wants the grocery store to feel cozy. She wants it to feel like the taquerias in the Rio Grande Valley, where the clientele is equal parts construction worker and dressed-up business person, and both are welcome. She wants it to be a sort of standard bearer. Being that we're so far from the border, if you don't travel, you don't know what it is. In Iowa, it's pretty unique to have these places that people can relate to. It's cultural and educating for other people as well. Some Iowa bars, other businesses decide to close amid virus. Some Iowa bars and other businesses are voluntarily closing their doors amid an increase in confirmed coronavirus cases. Among them was the Artifacts Antique Shop in Iowa City. Owner Todd Thielen said the store has seen three of its mostly older customers die because of COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus, the Gazette reports. The number of people who are not taking this seriously kind of frightens me, he said, explaining that the store will remain closed at least through Monday when he will reevaluate. I think they're being selfish. Confirmed coronavirus cases in the state increased by an additional 380 on Saturday, bringing the total to 27,935. The state also reported three more deaths to bring the total to 704. The number of infections is thought to be far higher because many people have not been tested, and studies suggest people can be infected with the virus without feeling sick. Iowa businesses that closed or limited operations at the beginning of the pandemic had started expanding operations as Republican Governor Kim Reynolds began easing restrictions. Jason Zeman, owner of Studio 13 and Yacht Club, said both bars were open for only 2 weeks before closing again Thursday. He said he would be checking case numbers to see if they stabilize in 14 days. If so, the bars may reopen, he said. If not, he will keep checking weekly. No one on his staff has tested positive for the coronavirus, but he's worried it's a matter of time. At that point, I said it's just not worth it, Zeman said. He said the vast majority of people he has seen in downtown Iowa City have been in their 20s and may not view the pandemic as an urgent matter. Of all the positive cases in Iowa, 66% have been in people ages 18 to 40. For most people, the new coronavirus causes mild or moderate symptoms, such as a fever and cough, that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia and death. Both the airliner and the field house, longtime bastions of college-age crowds, also have closed back up for now. For the health of our guests and staff, the airliner will be closed for dine-in and carry-out. Don't worry, we'll be back to hanging soon, the airliner posted on social media. The field house and next door DC's announced they would be closed through Sunday. We wish everyone an enjoyable and, most importantly, safe weekend. Thanks for all your support, the announcement said. Iowa woman arrested in hit-and-run crash that killed teen. A Des Moines woman has been arrested in a 2-year-old hit-and-run crash that killed a 14-year-old on a moped. The Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier reports that Fayette County Sheriff Marty Fisher said 26-year-old Kelly Jo Michael of Des Moines was arrested Friday and charged with vehicular homicide and leaving the scene of an accident and the death of Caden Essling. The teen from Maynard was struck in June 2018 while driving a moped along Iowa 150, about 2.5 miles south of Fayette. Michael is jailed on $50,000 cash-only bond. It wasn't immediately clear if she had an attorney who could speak on her behalf. Dubuque tattoo artist joins effort to erase hate. In his Dubuque tattoo parlor, Greg Howell can cover up a swastika, wolf's angel sword, and stylized runic symbols, but his art only extends skin deep. Hatred soaks into a person's soul, and drawing the poison out is a journey that, for some, takes years. "We choose the wrong path in life sometimes," he told the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. "It's okay to change course." Howell, 46, the owner of Dubuque Tattoo Club, is a bold designer and an imposing presence. His arms are a canvas filled with scowling skulls, sharp lines, feathers, and teeth. What cannot be seen are three tattoos, born from ignorance, the designs of which he cannot bring himself to disclose publicly. Howell had them covered after he left the fold of white supremacy almost two decades ago. He burned the accoutrements of his affiliation in his backyard, pouring gasoline atop a pile of white power albums, propaganda, and a jacket that bore a swastika. It was a history he could veil from scrutiny, but this month he chose not to. Howell recently signed onto an erasing hate campaign, joining other tattoo artists across the country who will cover up racist or gang-related tattoos at no cost to those who cannot afford to pay for the procedure themselves. But Howell believes he must own his past first, else be labeled a hypocrite. So, in a social media post, he told the world, "I was a Nazi skinhead." Howell grew up in the Flats, a neighborhood on Dubuque's north side identified as having the highest concentration of poverty in the city. His parents divorced when he was in sixth grade. In his father's custody, Howell moved multiple times, first within Dubuque, then to Maquoketa, Richland Center, Wisconsin, and finally Moline, Illinois, where he graduated high school. Howell described himself as an angry kid, lashing out at people when confronted. "It was hard for me to keep friends," he said. "It was hard for me to feel like a part of anything." Howell returned to Dubuque in 1994, picking up a job at the former Dubuque Packing Company. Some of his co-workers were skinheads. Off the clock, they gathered for drinks, partied, and rocked at white power concerts and rallies. All the while, Howell digested their beliefs. "They think white people are better than anybody else, that there is a conspiracy in the world to mix races and eliminate the white race," he said. "Their idea is that they are going to stop that from happening." Howell recalls that some of the men were addicted to drugs and others just angry. He calls them knuckleheads, but still they constituted a brotherhood. "I thought I found my place," Howell said. "At the time, it felt like a good thing. They make you feel like you're one of them." He acquired three tattoos, one on his wrist, his arm, and his leg. One of them he inked himself. Although Howell's compatriots were not affiliated with a national hate group, the Southern Poverty Law Center tracked 940 such entities in 2019. Two are active across Iowa. The National Alliance, a neo-Nazi formation, calls for the eradication of Jews and other races and the creation of an all-white state. Similarly, the hate group Patriot Front advocates for the formation of a white ethno-state. Many hate groups have appropriated images, such as the Iron Cross and Confederate flag, to use as symbols of their tenets. "People of color are very conscious of these symbols and what they mean," said Jacqueline Hunter, director of Multicultural Family Center in Dubuque. "When you see the Confederate flag, as a black person, we know that symbol has so much connection and meaning to a time in this country when we were enslaved." "Offensive symbols create barriers," she said. "You might be the sweetest person in the world, but once that barrier is up, that's a very hard space for me to navigate," Hunter said. "People's perception becomes their reality." After Howell's son was born in 1996, he began to drift away from his buddies. He cannot pinpoint a specific moment the mythology began to unravel, just a sense that the world his peers described was not the one in which he lived. Howell left the plant for long-haul trucking, which took him across the country. For 14 years, he encountered all kinds of people as he filled up at gas stations, unloaded freight at docks and warehouses, and supped at restaurants. As Howell's attitudes changed, so did his three tattoos. He had them transformed into a skull, a memorial, and a biker. "Artists in general are pretty open and understanding," Howell said. Although he dabbled in drawing throughout his childhood, Howell did not attempt a professional art career until 2003. He apprenticed at area tattoo parlors for years before launching Dubuque Tattoo Club in 2012. Now, instead of rallies, Howell travels to professional conventions. "It changes you," Howell said. "I found a new brotherhood that's better, one that's about love, man, and having fun." Leaving a hate group, like any gang, can be dangerous. A person who bears a racist tattoo but fails to toe the party line can be identified and threatened with violence, Howell said. The symbols also are permanent reminders of mistakes and pain. The cost of tattoo cover-ups can range from hundreds to thousands of dollars, depending on the size. Howell recalled a scenario in which a person inked with a swastika visits a public swimming pool. The tattoo is large, costly to remove, and the person lacks the financial means. "Everyone around there is being affected by this stupid tattoo," Howell said. "I don't want them to have money be a factor in whether they can get rid of it." To date, Howell has scheduled 6 appointments. One man's is the word hate, which Howell will change into a grim reaper. Another client has a gangster disciple symbol on his chest, atop which Howell will tattoo a skull and filigree. "Hatred is learned and can be unlearned," he said. "Erasing hatred through art is a movement far larger than himself. I just wanted to put something positive out there," Howell said. "Let's do it together." Cedar Rapids investigator among best at tracking people down. When prosecutors are tracking down a witness, looking for that one statement that confirms a victim's story or helps prove a defendant's guilt, they turn to their best man, who never gives up. Al Steele is humble and probably wouldn't say he's the best, but 21 criminal, civil, and juvenile prosecutors would beg to differ. Steele, 59, of Cedar Rapids, who retired after 36 years in law enforcement, made it only 5 months before taking another job as the investigator for the Linn County Attorney's Office. His friend, Jim Noonan, had been the office's investigator for 8 years and reached out to see if Steele was interested in taking over after he retired. "He just passed away a few months ago," Steele said. "Jim was one of the nicest human beings. Whatever Jim said was golden with me." Steele was hired and started with the office nearly 5 years ago. "I love talking to people," he told the Cedar Rapids Gazette. "I love my job. There's no stress for me. It's the most fun I ever had." He insists that he's just part of the support staff. He said the prosecutors and other staff are the ones working hard every day on the cases to help the community and victims. The prosecutor sees Steele as an important part of the team and recently nominated him for the Exemplary Service Award for Customer Satisfaction, a quarterly award given to Linn County employees. He received the award this month. "When I need an answer that requires boots on the ground, I know Al is the man to get the job done," First Assistant Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks said. "When I have a tough task on a case, I put my best man on it." Maybanks calls Steele a jack of all trades, because he follows up on law enforcement investigations, tracks down key evidence and people who don't want to be found, and serves numerous subpoenas every day for felonies, misdemeanors, and civil cases. Maybanks had a recent drunken driving case in which a defendant with 2 previous convictions was accused of crashing his car into a retaining wall. He claimed his passenger was the driver. Steele went to the scene to follow up with witnesses and reviewed body camera footage and 911 calls, which showed the defendant was the driver. The defendant ended up going to prison because of Steele's effort, Maybanks said. Assistant Linn County Attorney Monica Slaughter said Steele always comes up with new and innovative ways to track down people. "If Al can't find them, no one can," she said. Slaughter had a tough domestic abuse case with a victim who was 29 weeks pregnant and badly assaulted. The woman recanted her statement that the defendant, who had been convicted twice, had beaten her. Slaughter had to go to trial in less than a week. She asked Steele to find additional witnesses who could testify about the victim's demeanor, appearance, and injuries. He did. He also obtained surveillance video that showed the victim upset and crying when she called police from a convenience store. Then he found the victim, who wouldn't respond to Slaughter. He had a gut feeling that she was living with the defendant, so he staked out the house for 8 hours. He eventually found the victim on social media and persuaded her to come outside to accept the subpoena. The defendant was convicted, but Slaughter said the case would have never seen the inside of a courtroom without Steele collecting the additional evidence. Anastasia Basquin, Chief Victim Liaison and Community Outreach Specialist with the office, said the secret to Steele's success is that he can talk with and relate to anybody. He treats everybody with kindness and respect. Asked how he seems to find those nuggets of information that make the case, Steele said he relies on a lot of resources and a few little tactics he learned from his time with law enforcement, but added that he also strikes out sometimes. Steele grew up near Charles City in a farming family. Nobody in his family was in law enforcement, yet Steele said he knew in sixth or seventh grade that he wanted to be a police officer. He applied to be a part-time dispatcher at age 15 and got the job. "It was the coolest job ever," he said with a grin. "I wasn't nervous or stressed. It was a small town." After finishing a Friday night wrestling match, he would go to the police department, where he would sleep in the jail for a few hours until his midnight shift. Steele had planned to go into the Marines, but instead, at 18, joined the Iowa Department of Public Safety's Capitol Police in Des Moines. They provided security for the Capitol building and the governor and his family. He also started taking classes at Des Moines Area Community College, where he met his wife, Michelle. He became a state trooper, then worked in narcotics, and eventually the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. He retired in 2015 as a special agent in charge. Steele said he's good at his job because it's all about people. "It just requires being patient and never giving up, which isn't in my DNA. He uses social media and scours all the reports to locate people and evidence, such as surveillance video. He said dealing with people is all in the approach. With witnesses, he explains to them that a case is like a puzzle, and each piece of evidence puts it together. I tell them up front that I need to serve a subpoena," Steele said. "Some people may not even realize they could be a witness in a case. In one case, there was a guy who called 911, but said police never talked to him and he didn't think about being a witness." Campaign Almanac, What's in a Name, Rising Stars, and Newcomers. A roundup of campaign news items of interest. What's in a Name? Supporters of Teresa Greenfield and U.S. Senator Joni Ernst have taken pokes at each other this week over the candidates' difficulties with names. Democrats made fun of Ernst, who, while speaking on the Senate floor about the police reform package Iowa lawmakers unanimously passed, called Des Moines Democratic Iowa Representative Akeo Abdul-Samad Ako instead of Akeo, as he pronounces his name. Republicans joined the fun, sending out video clips of Greenfield repeatedly calling for Eric Wheeler and Andrew Weaver to resign as EPA administrator. Andrew Wheeler heads the agency. Rising Stars, Newcomers. Ernst and Iowa Representative Ashley Hinson will be featured in a Rising Stars and Newcomers on Firing Line with Margaret Hoover that will air beginning this weekend. Hoover interviews several of Republicans' rising stars in Congress, including Ernst, the first female combat veteran in the Senate. Others include Representatives Elsie Stefanik, the youngest GOP female elected to the House of New York, and Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington, the only Hispanic Republican woman in Congress. In the newcomers segment, Hoover talks to Republican women running for Congress, including Hinson, a former television reporter and anchor, challenging Democratic 1st District Representative Abby Finkenauer. She tells Hoover that one of her inspirations for running is the increasing number of conservative women in Congress. Rising Stars can be seen on Iowa PBS June 27th at 5 a.m. and June 28th at 5:30 and 11 a.m., and on PBS World June 28th at 1:30 p.m. Newcomers can be seen on Iowa PBS June 30th at 9:30 p.m. and July 1st at 4:30 a.m., and on World July 8th at 8:30 p.m., July 9th at 1:30 and 9:30 a.m., and July 11th at 12:30 p.m. Jody Huizentrout friends and family still hope for justice. 25 years after her disappearance, Jody Huizentrout's family and friends are still holding out hope. Co-workers and friends gathered Saturday in front of the KIMT TV station in Mason City to commemorate the anniversary of when the well-known KIMT morning anchor went missing from her apartment complex on June 27, 1995. Citing another cold case that had recently been solved, Janet Mason, the news director at a TV station in the Twin Cities that interviewed Huizentrout for a job, echoed the hopes of local law enforcement and family that the case could still be solved. I'm really hoping that Jody can hear me right now, because what I would like to say to her is that the people who love you and care about you have not given up in finding justice for you, Mason said. There's hope for solving Jody's case. This is a cold case that we want to solve. Kelly Boyle, a college classmate of Huizentrout, read a statement on behalf of the family at the gathering. Today, we have to say it is very sad and frustrating that we have not found our Jody and that justice has not been served in her case, Boyle read. To think it has been 25 years and we are still looking for her is unbelievable. How many times did we hear the phrase, you must have hope? Well, we must continue with this hope so we can find our Jody and also find who is responsible for this horrible act. If you have any information regarding Jody's disappearance, call the Mason City Police Department at 641-421-3636. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, June 27th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Barbara Joan Ward. Born December 26, 1953, died June 25, 2020. Barbara Joan Ward, a devoted mother and lifelong resident of Ventura, passed away peacefully in her home on Thursday, June 25, at the age of 66, after a hard-fought battle with cancer. A memorial service will be held 2 p.m. Saturday, June 27, at St. John's Lutheran Church, east of Garner, with Reverend Carl Hedberg officiating. Interment will be in the church cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to services at the church. Cataldo Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be directed to St. John's Lutheran Church. Barb was born in Mason City on December 26, 1953, the daughter of Marvin and Adelaide Schwischau Brager. She graduated from Ventura Community Schools in 1972. Barb then worked at Clear Lake Aluminum, where she met her husband, Christopher Arville Ward. They were married on September 15, 1973. On April 27, 1978 and December 3, 1982, respectively, she welcomed her daughter and her son, the greatest joys of her life. Throughout her life, Barb worked at Movie Time Video, Ventura Community Schools, Lake Fireplace and Spa, and Meals on Wheels, where she found fulfillment in helping members of her community. She was a lifelong member of St. John's Lutheran Church, where she had been a choir member for over 40 years, and a charter member of the St. John Evening Guild, serving as president and secretary. She also served as officer in the Fellowship Club, secretary treasurer of the Sunday School, and taught Vacation Bible School. Barb is survived by her mother, Adelaide Brager of Garner, her two children, Tiffany Ward of Ventura, and Dustin Ward and spouse Allison of Garner, her beautiful grandchildren, Jordan Nelson, Faith Primrose, Christian Ward, and soon-to-be Baby Ward, her siblings, Cheryl Nesbitt and spouse Jim of Clear Lake, Mike Brager and spouse Sue of Clear Lake, and Randy Brager and spouse Janet of Clear Lake, and numerous nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husband, Christopher, her father, Marvin Brager, parents-in-law, Pat and Charity Ward, brother and sister-in-law, Steve and Nancy Thompson, and her maternal and paternal grandparents. Barb's family wishes to extend a special thank you to Bon Kozisek of Mercy One North Iowa Hospice, Reverend Carl and Jan Hedberg of St. John's Lutheran Church, Dave and Kathy Pugel, Linda Luders, Madison Benzing, and all of her family and friends that visited during Barb's final weeks. Daniel L. McCormick. Born August 29, 1924, died June 24, 2020. Daniel L. McCormick, 95, of Garner, passed away Wednesday, June 24, at his home. A memorial mass will be held 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 27, at St. Boniface Catholic Church in Garner, with Reverend Father Jim Dubert officiating. Interment will be at St. Boniface Cemetery with military rites by the Garner Veterans Ceremonial Unit. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to services at the church. Cataldo Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be directed to Mercy One North Iowa Hospice. Daniel Lewis McCormick, the son of Michael and Inez Shaver McCormick, was born August 29, 1924 in Garner. He graduated from Garner High School in 1941. He enlisted in the U.S. Navy, serving his country during World War II. On March 23, 1945, he married Joyce Maria Gafka at the Navy Chapel in New York City. After his honorable discharge, they made their home in Garner, where Dan worked for the U.S. Post Office until his retirement in 1997. Over the years, he enjoyed playing church league softball for St. Boniface, golfing, bowling, playing cards, horse racing, going to Phoenix, Arizona during the winter, and most of all, spending time with family. He was a member of St. Boniface Catholic Church, where he sang in the church choir. He was also a member of the Knights of Columbus, Garner VFW, and American Legion, and the Garner Veterans Ceremonial Unit. Dan is survived by his two sons, Len McCormick and spouse Mary of Cedar Falls, and Paul Allen McCormick and spouse Rebecca of Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Grandchildren and their families, Sean McCormick and spouse Irene and their two children, Madeline and Delaney, Brian McCormick, Matthew McCormick and his two children, Cassidy and Delilah, Paul McCormick and spouse Brenda and their two children, Megan and Paul Allen, Amber Kingsley and spouse Jeremy and their two children, Ashley and Christopher, Morwen Gerson and spouse Andrew and their two children, Evelyn and Owen, Melinda McCormick, Shannon Zabel and spouse Nate and their three children, Peyton, Hayden, and Tristan, Danielle McCormick and spouse Frankie Flood and their son, Frank, three great-great-grandchildren, three sisters, Ruth Kilgore, Rita Curtis, and Jean Malley, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, wife Joyce, two sons, John and Brian, a sister, Cleo Anderson, and two brothers, Mike and Larry McCormick. Gloria K. Hudson. Born February 3, 1931, died June 24, 2020. Gloria K. Hudson, 89, passed away June 24th at Every Step Hospice Kavanaugh House in Des Moines. Gloria was born February 3, 1931 in Fort Dodge to parents Abner and Edna Black Stafford. She graduated from Renwick High School and received her bachelor's degree from Iowa State College. On June 9, 1957, she was united in marriage to Richard Hudson in Renwick, and they had three children, Deborah, Scott, and Anne. They lived in New Hampton 1 year, Monona 3 years, Clear Lake 6 years, Mason City 40 years, and in 2007 moved to Waukee. Gloria worked as an accountant and a teacher for over 32 years. She worked for Bankers Life, Garner Iowa Schools, New Hampton Schools, Hamilton Business College, and River City Ready Mix in Mason City. She was a former member of the Presbyterian Church in Mason City, where she served as a deacon and a current member of Heartland Presbyterian Church in Clive. She served her community as a volunteer at Mercy Hospital in Mason City, North Iowa Hospice, AARP Tax Services, and Every Step Hospice. She was also a member of the New Horizons Band in Des Moines. Along the way, Gloria became an expert in obtaining costly medications for citizens in Mason City, many of whom did not have insurance that covered their medications. The services she provided added up to over $1 million in benefits for the citizens of the community, gaining her recognition by the state of Iowa as a million-dollar volunteer. Gloria is survived by her husband, Richard, her children, Deborah Hudson of Mason City, Scott Hudson of Western Springs, Illinois, and Anne Hudson of West Des Moines, and three grandsons, Ryan, Daniel, and Jonathan Hudson. She was preceded in death by her parents. A memorial service will be held 10:30 a.m. Monday, June 29th at Isles Westover Chapel, 6337 Hickman Road in Des Moines. For those unable to attend, you may view the service through a live stream link that will appear just prior to the service on Gloria's obituary page at islescares.com, and Isles is spelled I-L-E-S, where you may also leave online condolences. Visitation will begin 1 hour prior to the service at the funeral home. Cremation rites have been accorded. Memorial contributions may be directed to Every Step Hospice. Back to virus basics, what you need to know to fight a new infection wave in 30-plus states. With infection numbers rising in more than 30 states, the U.S. this past week set another daily record for new coronavirus cases, and federal health officials warned that the number of people who've been infected may be vastly undercounted. The developments mark a heartbreaking situation that demands stricter actions immediately, said Dr. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. U.S. officials estimate that 20 million Americans have been infected with the coronavirus since it first arrived in the United States, meaning that the vast majority of the population remains susceptible. Some basic facts. While more than 2.4 million cases have been diagnosed nationwide since the pandemic started, the number of people who have been infected is likely to be 10 times as high. Antibody tests show more than 20 million people have been infected with coronavirus, most of them without knowing it, said Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Between 5% and 8% of Americans have been infected with the coronavirus, with the numbers varying by region. Coronavirus has killed more than 124,000 people in the United States, and confirmed cases are surging in a majority of the country. So far, 32 states are reporting an increase in new coronavirus cases this week as compared to the prior week. 11 of them report a 50% increase or greater. They include Montana, Idaho, Vermont, Nevada, Arizona, Texas, Florida, Georgia, Michigan, Missouri, and Mississippi. Meanwhile, federal health officials updated the list of who's most at risk of severe complications from COVID-19. The CDC added mild obesity to a list that includes the elderly, people with lung or kidney disease, and those with diabetes. People with moderate to severe asthma are also at higher risk, along with pregnant women, the CDC said. Those with cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease are also at higher risk, the CDC's Dr. Jay Butler said. So are those with conditions such as sickle cell disease, poorly controlled HIV infection, bone marrow transplants, or an organ transplant. The CDC also removed the specific age threshold, saying it's not just those over age 65 who are at increased risk for severe illness. The statistics may seem bleak, but health officials have said all along that individual behavior makes a difference. Epidemiologist Larry Brilliant told CNN, "If you let everybody out without face masks and without social distancing in the middle of a pandemic, this is what was predicted." Central Springs beats Rockford, hopeful for state tournament run. After two losses in Fort Dodge at the Class 2A state softball tournament a year ago, the Central Springs softball team has been on a tear to start the 2020 season. The Panthers hold a 9-2 record after beating Rockford 10-0 in five innings at home on Friday night in top of Iowa East Conference play. One thing about this whole team is there's not very many I's. It's all about us and what we can do for us to win this ball game, Central Springs head coach Belinda Nelson said. The squad is still undefeated in conference games, and the only two losses this season came against Class 5A Ankeny and Class 4A Winterset. "One thing that we talk about is getting better every game," Nelson said. "You can look that we've lost two games to big schools, but we want to get better every game, no matter who we play." Central Springs finished first in the top of Iowa East in 2019 with a 28-9 overall and 16-1 conference record. The Panthers made it to the state tournament but couldn't get a victory there, something that doesn't sit right with sophomore Kayla Fessler. "I guess we all really want to go back to Fort Dodge and actually do something this year," Fessler said. "In the past, our goal was to get there, but I think our goals are much higher this year." One thing that might help the Panthers get back and go deeper in the tournament this season is the 1-2 punch of Fessler and freshman pitcher Cooper Claussen. Claussen, a right-hander, started against Rockford Friday night, going four innings and earning the win. Fessler, a lefty, came in and pitched an inning of relief. Claussen now has a record of 9-1 as a starter. Typically, she starts and Fessler will come in and finish games out, giving opposing batters a different look to try and catch on to. "They're doing a nice job," Nelson said. "In their minds, they have each other's backs. Both of them know if I'm off a little bit, the other one will come in and back me up and vice versa." Fessler is also one of the top batters on the team. She went 4-for-4 at the plate on Friday night, good for three singles and a double. She's now batting an even 500 on the season. "She sees the ball really well. She's one of my stronger batters as far as seeing the ball," Nelson said. Fessler is just one of the many weapons the Panthers possess on offense. As a team, Central Springs is batting 370 and has four players who average 400 or above. For pregame, they take the drills very seriously. They know that it's not going out there and just talking and stuff, Nelson said. I think they're very focused. We see the ball well. We figure out what is our pitch and go after that one. The Panthers were able to score four runs in the first inning and two runs in the second. In the bottom of the fifth inning, four more runs were scored, ending with a bang when freshman Abby Pate hit a three-run homer to send Rockford fans home early. For Rockford, the Warriors were able to put runners on base in a couple different innings, but were never able to bring any runners home. Nelson doesn't want to admit that her and her team are looking toward the postseason, but she knows that it's looming. Of course, postseason is on our mind right now because it is only 2 weeks away, she said, but that's our goal, is to get better every game and improve. Addie Rugland, guest columnist, missing the family sitcoms of the 80s. With the cancellation of so many activities and calendar commitments at an all-time low, we've all found ourselves with a lot more downtime. For my family, sometimes that includes TV time. It's caused me to notice somewhere along the lines there has been a big change in programming. I know for the last 20 years, a large variety of reality TV has become a huge part of programming. But I'd never stopped to notice one TV genre has all but disappeared, the family sitcom. Sitcoms in general are fewer as the popularity of reality TV has grown and this genre is much cheaper to produce. But even sparser is the family sitcom. This is a big change from yesteryear. When I was a kid, sitcoms were aplenty, and more often than not, they appealed to the whole family, regardless of ages. Happy Days, Family Ties, Facts of Life, Who's the Boss, Growing Pains, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, The Wonder Years, Different Strokes, the list went on and on. Friday evenings brought the introduction of TGIF, a two-hour family-friendly lineup that originally included Full House, Family Matters, Perfect Strangers, and Just the Ten of Us. In preparation of this column, I asked my mom if she truly liked these shows as well, or was just putting up with them as she spent time with her kids. She confirmed she did indeed enjoy them too. Today, if there is a sitcom, it's not necessarily family-appropriate, or it primarily appeals to just the child. In the case of the latter, the kids tend to be know-it-alls and the parents are commonly portrayed as bumbling idiots, which, as an adult, is hard to watch. Currently, the 7 p.m. time slot on network TV might have a crime or medical drama or an adult-based sitcom, or else one of a variety of game shows, strength shows, talent contests, or reality shows. My kids and I do enjoy some of these, but I miss the sitcoms of years ago. My kids are 7 and 9, so at an age where we can watch something that appeals to all of us, if we can find it. Don't get me wrong, my family doesn't lay in front of the TV for hours. I know it's not good to spend an excess of time watching TV, but I do have good memories of watching with my family as a kid. I can remember my mom and dad laughing just as hard as my brother and I while watching The Cosby Show and Home Improvement. We'd all do our best Tim the Toolman impressions. My dad was the best, of course. I'd watch Scooby-Doo and He-Man with my brother after school. Not sitcoms, but still good memories. I watched Miss America pageants and The Golden Girls with one of my grandmas, and All My Children with my other grandma. Granted, The Golden Girls and All My Children weren't exactly geared for kids, but it was the 80s and we sure loved it. As I said, my family does enjoy some of the game shows and talent shows on network TV. Our recent favorites are Don't, Holy Moly, and America's Got Talent. But to find a sitcom we can all enjoy, we have had better luck on streaming services. Fuller House, Just Add Magic, and Alexa and Kate have been a few good discoveries. However, it's still hard to find something both my daughter and son enjoy. One show they both do love is The Floor is Lava. Again, it's not a sitcom, but a game show that brings the imaginative childhood game alive for adult contestants. It's a hoot. Also, Home Improvement reruns have been a hit. And now, a new generation in my family is doing the Tim the Tool Man grunt. Sometimes it's just nice to sit down, relax, and laugh together. This column has helped jog my memory of some great past family sitcoms, so I guess I just need to search the streaming services for these old favorites of yesterday, as I think they would be enjoyed just as much by my kids today. Commentary from David L. Ulan, Los Angeles Times. You may be ready for bar hopping, but I'm not reopening yet. The undergrad who lives in the back room keeps trying to get me to rejoin the world. Let's get coffee, she suggests one day. Let's take a drive to Santa Monica, she suggests the next. At 21, my daughter is long past ready to restart her life. She's been living at home since March 13th, when her mother and I picked her up at LAX. The three of us went into isolation that afternoon, and she has had enough. I have not. I am against reopening. I'm still hunkered down. Not forever, but for now. The pandemic isn't over, and in fact, the numbers suggest it is getting worse again. According to the COVID Tracking Project, cases are rising precipitously in Texas, Arizona, and Florida. Reuters analyzed the project data and found a 90% increase in week-to-week new cases in Arizona and about 80% in Texas and Florida as of June 21st. In California, the number of confirmed cases keeps increasing, with Los Angeles still a hot spot. And statewide, hospitalizations, which were somewhat steady, are also climbing. Dr. Anthony Fauci and just about every public health officer, epidemiologist, and respiratory specialist in the country is uneasy. People keep talking about a second wave, he said recently. We're still in a first wave. Data analysis by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington projects a total of more than 200,000 COVID deaths in the United States by the beginning of October. And yet a whole lot of us appear to have come to a collective reckoning that 3+ months of being careful is enough. The Onion evoked the absurdity of the moment with a parody news item announcing that Dallas had entered phase 4 of completely deluding ourselves into thinking that this pandemic has somehow stopped spreading and that we're safe. In California, aside from sports, live performances, and conventions, just about everything has at least partially reopened. For the last few weeks, we have seen the return of in-restaurant dining and limited access to retail outlets, bars, and gyms. Houses of worship can now host services for 100 congregants or less. The logic is that mandatory face coverings and social distancing will keep us safe, or at least safe enough. But as the LA Times' Luke Money, Hannah Fry, Stephanie Lay, and Ronggong Lin too recently reported, a mask rebellion is underway in some parts of the state. Anecdotally speaking, based on the walks I take most mornings, I'd say the rebellion is everywhere. Then, of course, there's the Trump administration's reckless approach to COVID-19. It's possible that the president's so-called campaign restart in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was so sparsely attended because there is at least one thing I have in common with some of his voters. I'm not ready to reopen. He chose to go ahead with the next rally in Arizona, where about 3,000 of his supporters filled the Dream City Church and hooted at the notion that masks were necessary. The argument for reopening comes framed largely as a matter of economics, and why not? Since March, more than 44 million Americans have filed unemployment claims. The financial effects of COVID-19 have been devastating, especially for the most vulnerable, low-income families, communities of color, and small businesses. Not unlike the institutionalized racism embodied by the killings of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, among so many others, or for that matter, the coronavirus's toll in the U.S., this is a pandemic of another sort. And yet, what happens if we go back too quickly? The effect could be more ruinous. Another round of shutdowns might have even larger effects on businesses that may be on the edge of not being able to stay solvent, Dr. Christopher Murray, an expert on the burden of disease around the world, told CNN. The most effective economic strategy for the short term, in other words, may be to support our local businesses from home. Look, I know I'm fortunate. Thus far, I've been able to work from home. I never went to the movies all that much or to the gym, and I can't remember when I last set foot in a synagogue, mosque, or church. Thus far, my version of reopening has been set out earlier on my masked walks to avoid the increased traffic on the streets. Until all the lines on the graph stay level or we get fast and accurate testing and tracking, we're stuck. Humans aren't setting the agenda here. The virus is. That may not thrill the undergrad who lives in the back room. It doesn't thrill me. But reopening too quickly is not just irresponsible, it's societal malpractice.
As I finished writing, the count was 187,349 cases in California, 5,577 deaths, and still on the rise. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, June 27th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.